Okay, hello everyone. I'm Derek Gebhardt. I'm a program manager on the Windows Experience team, and I work on the search contract and the app-to-app or file-picking contracts. So today I'm just going to kind of give a deep dive into all the different kind of core contracts we have in the system. I'll cover search, share, devices, settings, and finish with file pickers. And you're probably wondering, what is a contract? Why should I care? Well, contracts really define the requirements that as an app you have to meet to fit into one of these great flows that we have. And why should you care? Well, when you think about some of these experiences, you can allow Windows to do a lot of the heavy lifting for you and do a lot of the work so that you can focus on what your app's best at and leave the rest up to Windows. Also, these are going to be defined entry points in the Windows UI, so users will come to understand how to complete these scenarios and complete these tasks with these defined entry points, so you get kind of a usability gain by opting into some of these contracts versus trying to build stuff directly into your app. And finally, they're at another point, some of these are another point that allow you to drive users into your application. So you don't have to worry about the user always just launching your application from the tile, but you can allow the user to interact with your application in other scenarios, such as the picking scenarios and sharing and searching, without having to directly launch your application. So to start out with, I'm going to cover the search contract. And actually, recently, I just booked a trip to LA because the weather hasn't been so great in Seattle. And I'm interested in seeing what the weather is like in LA right now. So I'm going to launch the application. I can swipe from the right side of the screen to bring up the charms menu. And this is where you'll find a lot of the kind of core contracts and platform entry points to these contracts that we offer. So I'll start off with hitting search. And this will bring out the search pane. So you'll notice at the top of the search pane it says weather. That tells the user that it's scoped to the weather application and that this weather application indeed will support the search contract and opt into this experience. As I start typing, you'll see suggestions in the search pane, and these are provided by the weather application and only the weather application. And I notice that it already picked up Los Angeles for me, so I don't have to continue typing my query. I can go ahead and click that on. At that point in time, Windows will tell the weather application, hey, you need to display your search results view for Los Angeles. At this point in time, the weather application can customize its UI to show search results for Los Angeles, and it can really customize the content to be related to, or customize the UI to be related to the content type that it knows, in this case, weather. So let's say I'm also interested in seeing other things that are going on in LA since I'm going to be down in the area. So I'm just going to go ahead and click the news on. When I go ahead and click News On in the search pane, it'll launch the news application and tell the news application, hey, you need to show your search results UI for Los Angeles, and I can see kind of relevant news and information regarding LA. So why is search important? Well, it allows your application to be searched from anywhere within the system. And as I was saying earlier, some of these contracts provide great opportunities to drive users into your application. So for instance, maybe another application that's in the same space can't really give the user the correct answer they're looking for a query. This provides you an opportunity to fill that answer and provide them the answer that they're looking for. So what else, what do you need to do to minimally light up in the search experience? Well, the first thing is you need to integrate with all the APIs for supporting the search contract. That means you need to be able to support the ability to receive the search query from Windows. And when you're running, this is as simple as creating a search pane object, listening to an event that will fire anytime the user hits the search button. When you're not running, this all happens through activation. So basically, Windows will start you up. You'll receive an activation event saying, hey, you've been launched for search. Here's a search query. Go ahead and launch directly to your search results UI. The next thing is you need to design a search results page that's really tailored for your app's content. So depending on the type of app you're writing, how you represent results is going to be vastly different, right? So when you think about an image application, the way that image application is going to represent image results is going to be vastly different from an application that's focused on documents or focused on weather. And then the third step is providing search suggestions. So when you think about a touch-based model and going to a touch-based model and focusing a lot on touch, one of the things you'll find is users aren't as efficient with a touch keyboard as they are with a hardware keyboard. So being able to provide search suggestions as they're entering their text is extremely important to quickly get them to their search results view. So search entry point, maybe you want some more reasons for why you should integrate with the search pane versus, you know, in addition, drawing something in your UI like another search box and allowing the user to potentially have multiple choices. Well, as I kind of talked about before, you have the usability of benefit. So users are going to be accustomed to bringing out the charms and hitting the search icon and expecting that to be able to search applications. And they won't have to really dig through your UI and try to figure out where that search box is, if it might be hidden or might be in the right corner, the left corner, or the bottom. It's kind of always going to be in this consistent place. The other thing is, you don't have to put an ugly search box or figure out how to make a search box look good in your application's main view. You can focus on what the application wants to be best at and kind of leave these other this other search experience that they're not going to be doing at every single point in your application up to the system to display. And the final benefit you get is that the more the user uses the search pane to search in your application, the higher up you're going to be in the list of overall applications. So if the user is constantly using the search pane to issue search queries in your application, you might be the top application in that list, and that's very important when they're searching from other locations that don't have search functionality or potentially the start screen, so that they can quickly get into your app without having to scroll through that entire list of applications in the search pane. So the search results page, how should you think about designing the search results page? My biggest guidance here is start with the Visual Studio contract search contract template. It will provide you not only all the event registrations to support search, it'll provide you with the UI that meets our UX guidelines. This means it does things like displaying the current query the user entered, it aligns to our red lines and our silhouette. It also provides you a location where you can add your filters in. And then you can really just worry about things like customizing the display of the individual results to meet and match kind of the expectations for the content type. Search suggestions. So when you think about search suggestions, we offer two different functionalities in the search pane. And the way that search suggestions work is every time the user changes their query in the search pane, Windows will fire an event to your application and say, hey, provide us with the list of search suggestions you want us to display, and we'll handle pinging them. So the two different kind of options we offer for search suggestions, if you do indeed want to provide search suggestions, are query suggestions and result suggestions. Query suggestions are essentially the same thing as if the user typed that entire thing that you're suggesting and hit search in the search box. What this means is that it'll kind of trigger a notification to your app telling your app to display your search results UI for that query. It's just really a shortcut and gives the user confidence that they know that's a good query they should enter. Result suggestions are different. So you can think about result suggestions in terms of kind of like the people application. If you're searching for an individual person and you want to suggest that particular person and allow the user to skip going to the search results page and jump directly to the details of that person, they can use the result suggestion for that case. So anytime the user will click on these result suggestions, they're going to jump directly into the individual details. If you want to do both, you can combine them. The only kind of limit we really have is that you get a total number of 5 search suggestions in the search pane. And the reason we kind of use 5 is based upon a lot of research we did with Bing and looking at kind of, you know, how often users use, you know, the 6th suggestion versus the 5th versus the 8th and stuff like that. Find and page. So the key thing about find and page is it's not the same thing as search. Kind of what we've found from our studies that users have very different models for how they think about find on page versus how they think about search. So find on page is really about locating the exact instance of the text that you're trying to find in the current document or article that you're looking at and being able to navigate between the different instances of that term. Search is more about searching globally across your application's data store to kind of locate a particular item in your application. So what we're kind of really suggesting to people that are trying to design find experiences is don't use the search pane at all. We don't want to kind of conflict those ideas with users. We want to keep them separate. So here's an example of the Windows Reader application. It allows you to open PDFs and such and kind of view them and read them in its Metro-style app. And what you'll see is they really implement the find experience with this bottom app bar that gives you a text entry field that allows you to initiate your query, or not initiate your query, but type in what you want to find and easily navigate between all the different instances of that. One of the things we found that's really critical to this scenario is enabling users to quickly get to their previous and next commands after typing in what they're looking for, so they can quickly navigate through all the different instances in what they're looking at. Kind of some other kind of key high-level guidance points for Find is support Control F. A lot of users, especially a lot of enthusiasts, know that Control F relates to Find and Page. So if you are going to build this experience in, make sure that you're kind of registering for Control F and you're bringing up your Find experience whenever you kind of hear that combination of keys. The other thing is don't navigate away from what the user is looking at. Since this is Find on Page or Find what they're looking at, kind of help them stay in that context and be able to navigate within that context to find the matches of what they're searching for. So I'm going to open up now for questions on search contract. Maybe we can take a few of them, or we can wait to the end before jumping into the next contract, which will be a bit different.
Let's wait to the end, but ask everybody out there online if they're to start putting in the questions.
Okay. So next up is... Oh, sorry. If you guys have any questions on the search contract, feel free to start submitting those and we can review them at the end. So let's jump into the share contracts. So you probably are all aware of share functionality. You see this all the time on the web today. You'll go to a website and it'll give you a Facebook, a Pinterest, a LinkedIn, and you can quickly use these buttons to share that article or share that piece of content out on those services with your friends. Well, what Windows does is Windows offers a more generic way to support these scenarios outside of putting in six buttons on your app canvas and adding an additional one each time an application comes out or a website comes out that you want to support. The other kind of problem with the model today is you have to go out and like go to Facebook.com and learn how to, you know, integrate with Facebook and add that share button into your website. Where Windows tries to take a more generic approach where as the user gets more applications that want to be share targets or share content out, you'll automatically support those for free if you integrate with the share contract. And basically, we kind of divide the share contract up into two. We divide it up into the share source and the share target. So the share source is all about kind of the main application that you're viewing that provides the content it wants to share out. So this might be a URL or a text. And the share target is kind of like the application that takes this content and shares it out with your social network or does something very interesting with it. So let's run through a quick example. So let's say I'm in a Photos application and I got a photo up full screen. I can swipe out from the right side and click the share charm, and the share pane will come out and will enumerate all the different applications that I could use that to share the content that this main app on screen has provided. So this main app on screen is the share source. So in this case, the main app on screen said, hey, I have this great image that I want to allow the user to share out. Windows is smart about knowing the content type and only showing applications the user has installed that support images, right? So if I had an application that only supported URLs, it would not show up in this list because this application has only shared out an image type. So in this case, I have both the mail and puzzle app that support it. And if I go ahead and click the puzzle application, we are going to load up the puzzle application in kind of this hosted view, as we call it, and allow it to give a UI to the user to enable them to complete the share experience. So in this case, the puzzle application, what it means to share with the puzzle application, it means to create its own puzzle from an image. So it'll give me a bunch of different options for either creating an easy puzzle or a hard puzzle. So if I go ahead and click one of them on, it'll let me know it's working on this, and it'll say, hey, your new puzzle is ready. Next time you come into our application, it'll be there ready for you to play with and use. So kind of in this view, to kind of clarify what is owned by the system, what is owned by the application, that top orange bar that we saw at the top is owned by Windows. So Windows draws that. It'll use the color that you specify for your main app's color up there. And it allows the user to kind of, the back button allows the user to jump back in case they change their mind and want to share the content out with something else, with another application. So it'll go back to that previous pane we saw that listed all the different share applications. The content that's below that is the entire content that your application owns. So you can draw whatever you want in that UI. We recommend keeping it simple and to the point and focus on the share task and not allowing the user to do everything they can do with your application in the share UI. So once that puzzle application is done, or once any application is done with the share, it has the opportunity to create what we call a quick link. So a quick link allows you to jump into a specific sharing action with an application without having to directly go on that application and select that specific action. So if you think about the puzzle application, it offers a number of different choices here. You can create an easy puzzle, you can create an intermediate, you can create a hard puzzle, but maybe you're always creating intermediate puzzles, right? So as the puzzle app, you can say, oh, the user created an intermediate puzzle. I want to create a quick link to allow them to do that faster. And that can be published inside of the share pane. So it'll get published here. That way, the next time the user comes in, they can just click that and have the intermediate puzzle created without having to select that option inside of your application. So when you think about quick links, the other kind of really good example of quick links is the mail application. So if you're using the mail application to share to a certain contact over and over again, it becomes a pain to launch the mail application, type that contact in, and then hit the share button. Instead, that mail application can say, hey, the user just shared with their friend John. And then if they keep doing that, that will bubble up in the quick link so that they can quickly jump directly to that action without having to use the keyboard to type in that address again. So share source contract. So we kind of talked about this before. The share source is the main app. It makes the content available to all the other applications. Basically how this works is Windows will fire an event that says, hey, the user wants to share. Do you have any sharing content that you want to make available? And you as an application can provide a number of different formats, right? We support text, link, URIs, files. We also support custom formats. So if you're, let's say, a cooking application and you want to share a recipe, and there's a standard schema for sharing a recipe, you can share that content, and then other applications that are targets can listen and say, oh, I also support the custom format recipe. So it's very flexible. You can even include multiple different content types that represent the same thing. So let's say your application has the actual image itself and has a URI to the image. You can share both the URI and the image. That way you allow the user to select the application that makes sense, and you have more applications to choose from in their list. The other thing that you really need to think through from a design perspective when it comes to the share source scenarios is whether what you're going to do for explicit versus implicit selection of content that the user wants to share. So in this case, let's say I'm looking at the MSDN Dev Center, and I'm looking at this article on building a great entertainment app. When the user brings up the share experience and selects a share app, in this case, it makes sense for that source app to share the URL to the article and maybe even the text for the article, but the mail app says the URL is more important. From a user, it's very clear that, hey, you want to share this overall article, so you can go ahead and not require the user to select anything specific to support share. But in the case of the user selecting text and explicitly selecting something, that's a pretty good indication that the user wants to only share that specific thing that's selected. So as they bring up the share charm this time, you'll notice that the only thing that the source application shares out is that text directly, and the mail app just uses that. So we covered the photos situation, but you know, it's clearly obvious that the user wants to share this photo when they hit the share charm, so you don't have to require them to select that photo. So here's another view of the photos application that allows the user to select multiple things. And if they hit share, the share contract also allows you to add multiple files that you want to share out. So in this case, everything that is selected in this multi-selection view is able to be shared via the mail app. However, in the case where nothing is selected in this photos application and the user hits share, it's really hard to determine what exactly they want to share. So in this case, what the photos application does is it responds to that share event by saying, hey, we can't share anything right now. If you want to share something, go into the application and select the photos that you want to share. So it gives them a direct actionable message in order for them to complete the share experience, and doesn't try to guess and be smart about what should be shared. So sharing the content out, so if you're a target app, kind of what are the things that you need to think about and what are the things that you need to know? So as we kind of talked about before, the target app is enumerated based upon the content type. So it's really important to make sure you understand the exact content types and the potential custom content types you want to support if you're a share target. Sometimes it makes sense to support a lot of different things. Sometimes you might only support a URL or text. So that's something you will need to enter as you create your share target. The next thing that's very important is showing a preview to the user of what will happen. So if you remember, the mail application had this nice thing where it showed you the attachment, so it was clear, hey, you're going to send these as attachments versus copying the text in. So it's pretty good to give the user an indication of the kind of the content and what will happen once they complete the share scenario. And finally, use quick links. Like, if users have the option to pick from a number of different ways to share via your application, odds are users are going to do the same action over and over again. Use quick links to make their flow more efficient for them. So here's the puzzle application again. As an example, here's the maps. Here's the mail application. The other thing that's really important is providing a visual confirmation that the content is being shared out without just dismissing. So sometimes it's like super easy to share the content to your application or out from your application to a social network, and that will happen instantly. And sometimes that could cause this pain to quickly dismiss without the user being aware, oh, what just happened? Did I hit an error? Did it crash? Did it actually share? So it's really important, even if you're really quick at sharing your content, to give the user a visual confirmation that the sharing is happening and completed. We also offer Visual Studio templates for share targets. And this is kind of the default template that we offer for share targets. And you'll notice that it gives confirmation by disabling the text entry box, the share button, and providing a little progress ring and sharing text at the bottom. Quick link. When you think about quick links, we provide the ability for you to give an image along with a description. And we really recommend, if possible, providing an image for the quick link so that it's very obvious to the user what's going to happen. So in the case of the mail or people application, it shows you who you're going to share with. The one thing that we really strongly recommend here is do not just provide your generic app icon for a quick link. Because what happens is, what you'll see is you might see the mail application three times there and also in the regular list that's not a quick link. And it becomes very confusing for users to quickly decide, you know, what is a generic mail application versus a quick link. So we really strongly recommend not using your generic icon there. Cool. And if you have any questions on share, feel free to go ahead and send those in as well. Next up is the device contracts. So there are actually three device contracts that really allow you and your application to interact seamlessly with devices. We have tap and send, we have print, and we have play to, and we're going to kind of jump into the details of each of these. So we'll start off with tap and send. So basically what tap and send does is it enables devices with NFC to communicate with each other to pass content from one device to another device. And this is built into the devices charm. So again, if you were to swipe out the charms and you see the devices charm, if you click that on, you'll get an option for this tap and send functionality. The absolutely amazing thing about tap and send is if you're a share source and you support URIs or files, you will automatically work for tap and send. There is nothing else you need to do. Because essentially what happens for tap and send is when you click on the devices charm, we fire the share content requested event. And if you fill that with a URI or a file, we automatically say, yep, tap and send is going to work. We know how to get the content via the share mechanism, and we know how to provide that to another device. So not only does tap and send work between two Windows 8 slates, it also works between Windows and the phone. The one downside is it really does only support URIs and files. It will not work with custom formats or anything of that nature. And once I kind of walk through the scenario and you see how the data gets transferred to the other device, you'll kind of see why that's the case. So in our scenario, we want to send a location between Bing Maps. And kind of on the screen right now, on the left side, we have the sender or the device that's going to send the content. On the right side, we have an image that represents the device that's going to receive the content. So let's say I have the Space Needle selected in my Bing's Map application. And I go ahead and I bring out the charms and I select devices. It'll fire that event to the Bing's Map application and say, hey, what's your content for share? It'll say, I have a URI that represents the location of the Space Needle. When I hit tap and send, I'll get a message that says, OK, you can now tap this device to the other device that you want to send the content to. And so here's a quick illustration. When that occurs, the receiving device will display a toast for 60 seconds. It says, hey, we just noticed the content was transferred. Do you actually want to receive this content and act upon it? So what happens here is, when you click that on, it will invoke either the default protocol handler for the URI that was specified from the sending client, or it will invoke the default application that's associated with the file that this device made available. And because we have both kind of contracts for protocol handlers and file associations already baked into the system, that's how we can easily handle those two types of data via the tap and send mechanism. So then the Bing's Map application will load up. It will handle that protocol, that URI, and take you to that same spot in the application. So that's tap and send. So print, we'll quickly walk through some UI for it. So let's say you bring out the charms bar, and you go ahead and select the device's charm. Not only could you get tap and send here, you also have the ability to physically send some content to a printer. And I'm sure you guys are all aware of the typical scenarios here for print. Pretty much want to make something available offline to users that they can have a physical hard copy that they might want to take with them somewhere. So a lot of good examples here are maybe a recipe that they want to take into their kitchen because they don't want to take their slate with them. Directions somewhere, if they want to have some hard copy of directions they can take with them, are kind of a couple of really good examples. So let's say I go ahead and select Office Printer. Basically, Windows will draw this print dialog and handle the print preview, and on the right, the settings that are available for printing. So in this case, the number of copies you want and the orientation. Outside of some of the default settings that Windows offers here around the number of copies and orientation, as an application, there are a number of other predefined settings that you can say, hey, I want these populated into this print dialog, and you can tell Windows that. So when you're thinking about what you're printing, it might make sense to give some more options here, like color versus not color, and things of that nature that you would want to kind of have pre-populated and easily accessible here. And that's all up to the application that's supporting printing to specify those settings. In addition to some of the predefined settings, you can define your own custom settings. So when you think about a maps application, right, you might want to support allowing the user to print the map and the directions, maybe just the directions only if they don't want the map, or maybe just the map only. So those are kind of like other things to think about and other settings that you could potentially expose in this print dialog. And then the final thing that you need to do is when you provide the content, so in the case of a JavaScript app, providing the content is as simple as providing the DOM. When you provide that to the print APIs, you should really think about how you want to customize this format and this content so that it displays properly in the preview and prints properly. So you think about a model that's horizontally panning, right? You don't want your like map and directions to print on separate pages, and you might have a pretty background that's in your application. You don't want to print that pretty background, so you can use things like CSS to relay out that content to make it fit better with how you want it to print. You can remove your background image so you're not wasting the user's ink by printing this awesome, nice visual image you have in the background of your application. So if I hit print, that just gets sent to the printer. Next up, play two. So in this example, I might be in the video application watching this awesome HD surfing video. So what if I slide in, go ahead and click devices, and click the family room TV, what will happen is that will stream to the family room TV. So now this awesome HD video that's on my slate is also playing on the family room TV. And how the Play 2 contract works is it supports streaming any kind of digital media via the DLNA standard. So in this case, this TV supports DLNA. There are no real other protocols supported for Play 2 outside DLNA. But DLNA can be used for streaming things like music to home theaters and other kind of things outside of just the living room TV. Kind of some of the interesting things to think about as you're supporting the Play 2 contract is we don't require you to show the same video on the screen of the device or the application that the user is interacting with. So this presents opportunities to allow the user to do secondary actions while they're watching this video. So maybe they're able to, in real time, comment with their friends or make markers of specific scenes that they want to save. So you don't necessarily have to be showing them this full screen video also in your application while they're streaming it out. There might be some cool things to think through there as you go ahead and design your applications. And if you have any questions on the device stuff, you can go ahead and send those in. So next up is the settings contract. So what is the settings contract all about? It's really about giving the user in context quick access to core settings anywhere they are in your application. And this will work the same across the entire system. So if the user goes ahead and accesses settings in your app versus another app, it should all behave the same way. So they get this really nice consistent experience. And kind of what the differentiators are between what the system provides and the app provides. So the system provides kind of this default entry point via the charms bar, that's the charms location. It provides a nice UI that will render kind of some of the system settings that are always available along with the settings of your application that you want to expose. And it provides a nice flyout control that allows you to quickly present the details and options of the settings that you want to make available. And what your app provides here is your app provides a list of high-level settings that you want to make accessible. And then it provides a UI surface that gets painted into this settings flyout control anytime they select one of these high-level areas. So we can quickly, I'll give you a quick demo. Oh, I did not want to go next. So if I swipe in from the side, you'll notice I have the settings charm at the bottom. If I go ahead and click the settings charm, this is scoped to the desktop app, but you can imagine your application having a different set of settings here that it wants to populate into this UI. So maybe you have accounts or preferences of that nature. And then if you selected one of these settings, you would get a nice flyout control. Let's see if I can bring up an app that'll showcase this, where you can kind of interact with the more detailed settings. So in this case, there's a flyout control here that has some different settings that relate to Internet Explorer, where I can easily access these and go ahead and change those. So as a kind of designer or developer that's going to integrate into the settings, what you own is you own this UI surface here that will get painted inside of the flyout control, so you can really customize it to include the different types of commands and controls that relate to the settings that you want to expose. So let's see if we can flip back. So kind of how you think about defining your settings commands and some kind of tips to think through is think about things that will be exposed globally across your app and aren't specific to an individual item that's selected. Each time the user brings up the settings charm and clicks on the settings to see the settings in your application, we expect the user to be able to see those same things so they know that there's a consistent way they can get to those settings. Other things to think through are don't use existing system settings names. So you'll see things like rate and review on there automatically populated by the system that'll allow the user to go to the store and rate the application, and permissions around notifications and such. We don't recommend using those names just because it creates a lot of confusion. And then finally, in theory, you could navigate to a specific entire page for settings anytime the user selects one of those settings in that first flyout, which contains just a text list of high-level overview names. We don't recommend that. We really recommend using that system flyout control where you define the UI surface just so we have some more consistency and it doesn't really take the user away from what they're currently interacting with in your application. So what are some great examples of app settings and what are how would you kind of group things together? So we kind of already talked about account management where you would handle sign in, log out, changing your profile. Other things that we're seeing a lot of applications use this for are just privacy statements, terms of service, help, because these are kind of like generic things that apply across the application and they really allow you to offload these details from your main app UI into the settings area. So some notes on kind of the UI surface that we make available or the system settings flyout that you can kind of dump stuff into with your UI surface. There's two different versions of this we offer. We offer a wide version, which is 646 pixels, and we offer a narrow version, which is 346. So if you don't have a lot of content and a lot of text, you might just want to go with the narrow version so that the user sees more of your main application when this system flyout control or settings flyout control pops up. We also really recommend using common controls. Users will get to know how to use kind of the toggle button, the push button, kind of when they apply. So we don't recommend going off and creating your own custom control. Plus, it helps you get settings done faster. The last thing I really want to mention is instant commit. Like, we don't recommend putting an OK cancel button in this flyout. Each time the user changes their setting, you should just instantly go ahead and commit that without asking them for confirmation for most scenarios. So that's settings. The last thing we want to talk about is the file picker contracts. And basically what the file picker contracts allow you to do is they allow you to provide a location in the file picker where users can pick files from your application to import into another application. And what I mean by the file picker, if you think about Windows 7 and Microsoft Word, if you go to File Open, you'll get this dialog that lets you pick a file from any, you know, folder or, you know, device that you have connected to your machine. So the modern or Metro file picker is just an extension of this, but instead of only allowing you to pick content or files from your local machine, you can also pick files that come from another app. So for instance, if the user has a photo app and they have all their photos on the cloud, you could easily, as that photo app, say, yep, I want to support the file picker contracts and be a location where the user can pick files from. We can go ahead and give you a demo of this. So if we go to change PC settings. So in this case, let's say I want to pick a new lock screen image for this machine. I hit browse to select the image or the file that I want to associate with this. You'll see it'll launch what we're calling the picker. That will be defaulted to the pictures location or pictures library, which is a local location on the machine. If I go ahead and tap the files dropdown, I'll see all the locations on my machine and all applications that allow me to pick pictures from them. So just like the share contract, how it filters out applications based upon the content type, the picker contracts filter out applications based upon the file extension that the client app specifies it wants to receive. So I can select photos. Here, what you'll see is the photos application is loaded in the middle. So the Windows Chrome or Windows UI is still on the top and the bottom to allow the user a consistent experience between navigating locations and adding stuff that they want to select. I can go ahead and select, I want to pick something from my pictures library through my pictures application. And let's say we want to select this great photo here. We'll hit choose picture. And what will happen is that Photos application will provide that photo back to the client application. It'll think it's just a regular file. It can go ahead and interact with that and do what it wants. So in this case of using settings, it's just going to set that to the lock screen image. So this is really cool because a lot of the user's content is no longer on the local machine. Users are using services to put their content up, you know, on Facebook, on Flickr, and all these other sites, and it's been hard to get that content down to their machine and into an application where they might want to use it in. So let's go back to our slides. So let's talk about the UI that you can display that runs in the File Open Picker. So our recommendation for this UI is to use something that is extremely similar to your main application, right? Users are going to get to know how to use your main application, how to browse the content in it, how to navigate through it, and it's kind of essential to use that same those same details and that same UI design in the picker, so users have this consistent model of how to interact and how to use your application. They don't have to learn something new specifically for picking. So let's go to the next slide. The other thing that we allow you to do is via the APIs, we allow you to set the subtitle text in the Windows Chrome. And this is very useful for telling the user what location in your application they are on. So in the case of Photos application, you might say, oh, you're looking at the pictures library. Or if you drill into SkyDrive through the Photos application, it might tell you SkyDrive. So it's a good way to give the user more information about the current location they're looking at without having to draw that out on screen. The other thing that we recommend is putting all of your commands in what's the command bar. So you'll see directly above the images in the photo UI that has the dark background, you'll see there's a back button. And kind of that row right there is where we recommend putting all actions that users, all actions or commands that users might want to take in the UI. And we also only recommend commands that are relevant to the picking experience. So maybe going up a level or filtering your view to change it based upon date, or any other kind of mechanisms to help them browse the content and select the content. The one thing to note is that swipe will not invoke the app bar. We do not recommend that people put the app bar inside of their picking UI and instead use this command bar, because swipe, it's hard for users to understand swipe makes sense, so we've blocked that out and we kind of came up with, you know, replacing just only the core commands from your app bar into the command bar. So kind of quick, we've already kind of talked about removing some of the core commands and putting them in the command bar. The other thing about the file open picker is there's two different modes it can run in based upon how it's launched. So the client app can say, I only want a single file back, or the client app can say, I'm okay receiving a lot of files back. So in the case of the lock screen, it only wants one image because it's going to set a single image as your lock screen, right? But a mail application could allow you to pick multiple images or multiple files to use as attachments because it supports multiple attachments. So that's something you really need to watch out for when you're going to build your UI or incorporate your application into the file picker. You need to be able to support multiple selection, or it could feel weird to users that everywhere else and in all other applications they can select multiple files but not in your application. So there's one kind of other unique scenario that we see a lot of applications opting into the file picker, and it's kind of these webcam scenarios that allow users to take their picture in the picker and then go ahead and submit that picture as the image that they want to select. And in these type of scenarios, we really recommend not putting a lot of the advanced setup and customization features inside the application, but really only focusing on the bare minimum effects and pre-processing effects that the user needs to get their picture and get it into the application. Because in the end, these UI and these user experiences that are within the picker should all about be all about enabling users to get to the image they want to select and import back into the application. So just like the open picker, there's also the ability to opt into the save picker. So when an application says, hey, I have content I want to save off somewhere, as a file, you can be a location that the user can save to. So when you think about SkyDrive, right, it wants to allow users to save files directly to it so that it can upload it to the server. And the save, the file save picker contract enables this. Kind of one of the core guidance points here that we give for the file save picker is if you're just going to mimic the behavior of a local location, it's not really necessary for you to opt in and provide a file save experience, right? Because the user can navigate to any of these local locations via the picker, via that drop down I showed you guys, and just directly save the file there. But if you do have locations that, you know, are going to get uploaded to a service or kind of very unique to your application that you can't really access through the normal file picker, this is kind of where it makes sense. Just like the open picker, your save picker UI should be very similar to your main application. And the one thing we do recommend is there's the ability for the user to select the content type they want to save off as. So as a client app, you might say, I support the ability to save to a PNG, or I support the ability to save to a JPEG. Well, in the case of them supporting multiple types that the user can save to, the picker will add that to the save bar and allow the user to select the type. And our big recommendation here is if the user changes the type that they're going to save to, is to update your view and only show files related to that type so they can be aware of what they have already on their machine that's, or already in that location that's of that type. The last contract we have is called the cache file updater contract, and this allows real-time updates. After an item's been either saved to, after a file has been saved to an application or opened from an application. And let me give you kind of a core example of the CFU scenario. So let's say you have this application that allows you to add mustaches to your friends, right? And you go ahead and you import a photo from the Photos application into this application so that you can add a mustache to your friend. One of the core features that a lot of these applications will offer is just the ability to directly save the file after they get it, right? With the file open picker contract, there's no notification that that file you provided has been updated. But with the cache file updater client, as soon as that application gets that file and makes some changes to it and saves it back, you will be notified in the background saying, hey, this file has changed. You gave this file to the mustache app and it has changed the contents of it. Here you go, do something with it. And then you can go ahead and make that file be uploaded to your server so it's reflected on your server in the background. So the next time the user comes and interacts with your photo application, they'll see that that file has an image on it. The cache file updater contract is totally optional. Not only does it support saving back into the file, a lot of applications will have a most recently used list where they can come back, you know, 2 months later and say, I want to go back to this file and continue working on it. At that point, we will launch your application in the background if you support the cache file updater contract and say, hey, we want the latest version of the file, because in reality, the user could have been somewhere else modifying that file on the server, and the next time they open it in that other application, they want to see the latest version. So this will allow you to do that as well. Some core things from the design standpoint to think about and related to the cache file updater contract is there are going to be cases where there are conflicts, merge conflicts, right? Pretty much this cache file updater allows you to sync the file between the application that you granted access to it and your backend. So there are going to be times when things change and become out of sync. And at that point, it is acceptable and allowed for you to show UI that tells the user, hey, there was a conflict when we tried to merge this version. What do you want to do? Do you want to keep both of them? You might also get scenarios where an application tries to save to a file and the user is no longer logged in your application. You need to show some login experience. Anytime you need to show UI, though, for these background saves or these background updates of files, we really recommend keeping it simple and really focus on allowing the user to quickly complete that task. And that's it. So again, why should you care? These contracts allow you another location or another opportunity to draw users into your application. They allow you to get content into your application, and they really allow you to light up scenarios by allowing applications to work together to complete an end-to-end experience. And then I guess I'll go with questions.
Cool. Thanks, Derek. Can you just do one more ask out there to the video?
Sure.
Yep,
so if anybody has any questions, go ahead and send them in and we'll start seeing if we can answer some of them.
Great. And so does anybody have a question in the room there? Okay, well there's a plethora of questions online, all right. Let's see. So VampC asks about exposing that share contract with custom data.
Yep. Yep.
And so I'm gonna ask you a loaded question.
Uh-oh.
And say, where can I go to find out information on the standards that I might use to do these kind of custom?
Yes. So the one place we're really
Yeah.
So there was a question about custom data formats and where you should go to find what are some of the custom data formats that people have started using. Do we have any recommendations about the custom data format types? The one place that we've really been recommending to people around custom data format types is schema.org. Schema.org has a lot of great schemas for different things like restaurants, locations, places, and they're already predefined. So that's kind of been our recommendation so far if you're going to do custom data formats. So the question is, can you override the back button in the share target UI that kind of appears and is drawn by Windows above your application? The answer to that currently is no, we don't support overriding that. We want to enable a consistent experience for users. So when they click that back button, it will go back to the previous share pane.
Thank you. And spin button on Twitter asks, what about DRM for movies and sharing movies? What's the story there?
I will have to get back to you on the DRM story. I can follow up with the share PM.
Cool. Going back to the mail, email, Julian asks, how do you determine what image thumbnail is shared? On the IE sharing example, you shared a link of a web page, and the thumbnail was automatically filled by an image in that page. How do you do that?
So the question was about how do you determine the icon or image related to the content that's being shared. So this is up to the source application. There's a set of metadata properties that can be filled in by the source application. You have a bitmap that just kind of generally represents the content that's being shared out. So if you're sharing a URL as the browser, you can also add an image that kind of corresponds to that URL. The other thing you can add is a title and a description to the metadata. And then that will get transferred over with the data to the share target that receives the application. The other potential there, though, is if you want to get your own custom image, as a share target, you are going to receive the URL as soon as you're launched that the user wants to share, and you could, you know, query that URL and potentially see if you can pull an image for it yourself if you don't want to rely on the metadata image or if it happens to be missing.
Fabio, our friend, is back again, and he asks, it seems like quick links are created by the share target app. If so, how do you guys keep the share UI from getting cluttered with these quick links? I can see many applications that can receive a picture broadcasting quick links.
Yep, that's a great question. So the question is, how do we manage and control the number of quick links that are populated by the share target after sharing flow is complete? We have an algorithm that manages how often users use quick links, and we only really display some of the top quick links, so we don't allow the kind of share UI to get out of control. And we also use kind of recency too. So there's this kind of custom algorithm that we have to know how many and what ones we should display in that UI. Yeah, so I think this kind of comes back to the question is, how do you handle searching within specific contents or contexts of your application, such as the, like if you're in the help context? So, I mean, it really depends on if you're trying to search exactly the help article you're looking at or the entire help collection of articles, and you might not actually be looking at it. If you're literally just trying to find a word or find something in the article you're looking at, we really recommend using the find and page pattern. If you are actually trying to change up the context that you want the user to search in, let's say you have an application that allows you to browse both photos and videos, and depending on in which kind of context you're in, you want to change up search. So you can do this. Essentially, anytime the user submits a search, we tell you, hey, the user searched for this query. And if you think it's appropriate UX to go ahead and only show results for one of those specific contexts, or specific context the user is in, you can go ahead and you will know that because you're the application. And when you receive the query, you can know what context you're in and show results for that context. But we really recommend making sure it's clear to the user that they know that they're going to search that context. The other thing that you can do is you can also do a broad search across all the app's contexts. And then in your search result UI, give them great filters to be able to filter to a specific context in and of itself. So if you supported both photos and videos and they were separate contexts, you could show your search result UI and then allow great filtering options to pivot into the photos or videos results.
Cool. Before I dive back into email questions, any other questions in the room? Okay. Erin actually is emailed in again whilst you're talking. She's on fire there. Can tapping a button on the canvas of the Metro app automatically activate a specific charm?
So we do have API, can tapping on a button in the UI of an application activate one of the charms or charm flows? We do, pretty much all of our charm flow APIs have a show method that will kind of invoke the flow of that experience. We strongly encourage people to rely on the charms because it allows you to kind of focus on content, and we have one of the core UX principles we have is content over Chrome, so leaving the Chrome off screen. There are definitely going to be some cases, though, where you need to invoke the share flow. One specifically could be around achieving a high score in a game, and you want to allow the user to share out that high score after they achieve it. You want to make it really clear once they achieve it that they can share it. You know, in that case, it is okay to go ahead and put like a share this high score button, and that will essentially call the share charm flows show API, and that will kind of start the flow for that charm.
So my understanding was that when you're searching for something, you can either show search suggestions, like, you know, if I'm searching for stuff to do in Seattle and I start typing it, then like stuff to do in Seattle will be one of the results.
Yep.
But then you can also have result suggestions, so like one of the things might be the Space Needle or something like that. Is there any way in like the search charm UI to differentiate that for users so that they know that clicking one of those things in the list will complete a search, but clicking the other thing will take them to a page?
Yep, so we just had a great question on how do users have an expectation of the difference between query suggestions, which take the user directly to a search results view, versus a result suggestion, which will take the user directly to the details of an item. In our UI, we have result suggestions represented by an image and text, and query suggestions represented by text only. And this is kind of the mechanism we give to users to help kind of, you know, enforce the point that clicking this will take you directly to the item versus a text one will kind of initiate a search. And kind of the follow-up thing that we see out of that is, well, what happens if I have a result item that doesn't actually have an image associated with it? For example, I have a dictionary definition, right? And that will take me directly to the definition versus a list of a bunch of terms that might be related or might be what I'm looking for. And in that case, we recommend creating a generic icon that represents the type of result it is. So in the case of a dictionary, it might be an icon that represents a definition, and just using that same icon for all of your result suggestions. But we really, really, we really enforce the image just to make it clear to users. What is the difference between the search charm and how you activate search and how you activate the find experience? So our recommendation is for search, continue to rely on the search charm, and that will invoke the search pane. For the find experience, we really recommend putting an app bar command for find, and that will kind of invoke a second app, like app bar-like thing that has a box where you can enter the term that you want to find along, and also two commands for next and previous to quickly iterate or quickly go through all the results for find, or navigate between the highlighting of the different matches for find.
And then Christian has asked, could you repeat how apps that implement the share source contract or are a share source can let users select the right thing to share in case of ambiguity? Is there anything we can push users down?
Sure. So how do we let users know what the content that they want to share is, or make it obvious to the user what content's going to be shared from the main application that is the share source? And this is really up to kind of the design of the application to make it clear to users. So we saw examples where, you know, if it's really obvious to the user that, hey, they're looking at this photo, you don't need to allow them to select the photo in order to share it because it's pretty obvious. So you basically need to kind of evaluate your designs and see if there is one main thing that makes sense to share for what the user is looking at. If there's not, and you want to make the user explicitly select something with selection for it to be shared, anytime they initiate the share charm, we recommend providing them a message if they haven't selected anything with actionable directions for, you know, determining what they want to share.
Thank you. And then Vasco asks, if I don't need to use all of the charms in my app, let's say I just need to use three,
sure,
how will the charm buttons or contracts react if I don't need to use them?
Yep. So the question was, what if I only need to use three, or if it only makes sense to use three of the charm flows in my application, how will all the charm buttons react? So I'll kind of go through each of them. So for search, It'll say that this app does not support search with some text, and it'll give the user an opportunity to search another application. So they can enter a query and tap another application inside of the search term. And it will also default to the user's top application that supports search if they don't actually physically tap, if they just hit enter or hit the search button. The devices charm, so if you don't support tap and send, or if you don't support supplying a URI or a file via the share source, the tap and send option won't be available. If you don't support print, you won't see any printers that you can print to, even if you know it's available. Like, let's say there's a printer on the system, but you don't support print, the printer won't show up. And for Play2, if there's devices that support DLNA, but you don't support Play2, they just won't show up in that device's pane. For settings, when you swipe open and you select settings, it will not show any settings that are available specifically from your application, but you'll still be able to access the generic, you know, power on, power off, brightness, and some of the other high-level commands that are in settings, along with some of the system-provided settings for your application, such as rate it or permissions.